So welcome to this podcast of the European Survey Research Association. My name is Vera Tupel and I am the president of the ESRA, and I will be the host of a series of podcasts that we are doing for the survey research community. We have done some previous podcasts during our last conference and that was a big success, so we decided to do some more and put them on our website. The first podcast will be on the use of probability and non-probability samples. And with me are two experts on this topic. Welcome, Kea and Karina. Let me introduce you. I will start with Kea. Kea Tijdens has been a full professor at the Erasmus University of Rotterdam for sociology of women's employment. And very important, she has been the research coordinator of the wage indicator, which is one of the largest and longest running non-probability panels in the world. Welcome, Kea.
Thank you.
And my other guest is Karina Cornesse. She is the survey methods researcher at the German Institute for Economic Research and the Research Institute Social Cohesion, where she is the coordinator of the new German Social Cohesion Panel. Welcome, Karina.
Hi, Vera.
Hi. So I believe there has been a paradigm shift in the last couple of decades. When I started working in the survey field, we were preaching to our students that they should always use a probability sample, or otherwise they would be likely to have biased results. And I think nowadays using non-probability samples is much more common. And I don't know if you would agree, but my first question would be for Kea. So when you started a relatively long time ago with the wage indicator, what made you decide to do a non-probability sample?
Yes, well, we started with the wage indicator in the Netherlands, and we wanted to collect data on wages for a wide range of occupations. Given that occupations are very skewed distributed across the labor force, that meant that we had to have a very large sample in order to have a coverage of sufficient number of occupations. Moreover, we wanted to focus on women only for several reasons. By then, we decided, we had a cooperation with the four largest women's magazines who have a coverage of more than a million women. And they promised to print our survey in their magazines. And that's what they did. So we ended up with 15,000 completed surveys from those magazines and also from some other magazines. So that was our non-probability sample, because we did not have any other outlets to go for such a large number of respondents, such a large number of occupations. And that's how we started with non-probability sample. Then we discovered that it was easy to put a whole survey online on a website. And that turned out to be a big success. Another 15,000 respondents came in reporting their wages. And that was due to the fact that the survey was posted on a website that was frequently visited by women. So by then we had loads of data. And then we continued, we got grants to go to other countries, got grants to expand the survey to male workers as well. So by now we have a non-probability web survey running in almost 200 countries. So already the first one started in 2000, so that the first one now runs for 22 years. And our recruitment methods are like this, that our website, the Wage Indicator website, has more than 40 million visitors a year. And those visitors are on almost all pages asked to complete the survey. And then we do, in addition, some social media outreach to invite respondents or possible respondents to complete a survey.
And did you ever find some resistance from the survey community in that you are using a non-probability sample and that they thought that results might be biased?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But so there's several ways to look at this. Sure. And well, let me first say that I really think that the gold standard in the survey community should be a probability sample. But there are reasons to have non-probability samples. And so, yes, in some areas there was resistance. Hey, you're doing a lousy survey, which is true. But on the other hand, we have had quite a number of papers published in academic journals who accepted our paper and did not. Well, they ask questions about the bias, possible bias in the papers. But as soon as we could identify that our main dependent variable for the paper was not so deviant from a probability sampled estimate for the same variable, then we always could go on. So then it was, at that point, it was accepted, and that applies to, we've had more than 10 papers published this way. And well, that's accepted.
Yeah. So how do you check the quality of your indicators? Is that by combining it with a results with a probability sample, or do you have other ways to check the quality of the indicators?
We have done a couple of studies in which we merged for the same survey our non-probability sample with probability, the data from a probability sample. For example, we used for the Netherlands the LIS panel from Center Data to check our findings and see to what extent they are biased. And we found for the wages on average, there's a 50 euro cent difference.
Okay.
So
that's not a lot.
That's not a lot.
No. I would be satisfied with that result.
Okay. So we did a couple of studies really testing the findings, the results, the data of probability and non-probability samples with all kind of statistical methods and weighting. Rating efforts. Yes.
Okay. So your comparisons would like more or less prove the quality of your data set compared to the probability sample.
Yes, for the high income countries. For example, when we also run a survey in Vietnam. And the internet population, the population that has access to internet in Vietnam differs largely from the population that has access to internet in the Netherlands. So for Vietnam, we see an overrepresentation of young, high educated males predominantly. So we do every now and then, we do a worldwide check for the distribution regarding gender and age group. That is possible, so that data is available to do this kind of checks. And then you could do some weighting, but so far we do not really do that unless we have specific papers. Remind that we are a continuous survey, so whenever we do a paper, then we sample a selection of this continuous data set for years or countries or age groups or whatever.
Okay, thanks. Okay. And Karina, you have been working a lot on of the comparison between probability and non-probability samples. What has been your main conclusion?
Well, I think, first of all, I come from a probability-based panel study background. So my background is quite different from Kea's. In fact, I started my career in survey research and applied survey research nearly exactly 10 years ago as an intern with the Gesus panel, which is a probability-based mixed mode panel in Germany. And I stayed there for a while, and then I moved on to the German Internet panel, and there I got my PhD in survey methods. And then I moved to the Mannheim Corona study, and now I'm with the German Social Cohesion panel. And all of the panels I've worked for have in common that they are based on probability samples of the general population in Germany, either a random route area samples or population register samples. All of them also have in common that they are based on multi-stage sampling procedures, because in Germany we do not have a population register, but lots and lots of population registers. So I think that's relatively unique. And the panels also have in common that they at least have a web survey component to them. So the Gesus panel and also the social cohesion panel, they are mixed mode panels of the general population with a paper and a web component, while the German Internet panel and Mannheim Corona study, they relied on the web mode only. And also all panels made efforts to integrate people into the samples that do not use the internet at all, either via the mixed mode approach or by equipping people who do not have access to the internet with necessary equipment like PCs or tablets. And so that is my background, and I've been working on these studies for 10 years now. And all throughout that time, people have asked me whether it is actually worth it to invest so much into these panel data infrastructures, not just funding, but also our time, because these infrastructures require a number of people with the right expertise to set them up and keep them going. And so I became interested in answering this question, whether it's worth it, because I think it's a valid question, right? So over the years, I had the great pleasure to be involved in a number of panel comparison studies, some of them looking into different modes of panels and others looking into probability versus non-probability panel studies. I think most notably, I worked on a study we conducted a couple of years ago at the University of Mannheim, where we conducted three parallel waves of data collection in 10 panel studies. So we had a lot of data for comparisons across these panels, and we looked into the accuracy of the results from these studies and compared them across panels. Some of the panels were probability and others were non-probability samples. We also looked into the response quality of the respondents across these different panels and into measurement equivalence across the instruments and retention rates across panel waves and so on. So we looked at lots of data quality aspects. And based on this primary research that I've been doing there with many others, with a team of researchers, I also began to think more in terms of a broader picture of what that really means, the findings that we got in these different studies for the overall debate about probability and non-probability survey samples. And I've been teaching on probability and non-probability samples, most notably at the Gesus Summer School in Survey Methodology. And I also had the great opportunity to write an overview paper on the debate about probability and non-probability survey samples with a number of international experts, which was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot from that. And I think my
What were your main conclusions in that paper?
Well, in that paper, that was an overview paper, we basically concluded that whenever possible, you should use a probability sample, just as Kia said. And in particular, when in contexts where it really matters to get things right. Right. For example, when political decisions depend on the underlying data, and in particular, when you look at univariate estimates, like, for example, vaccine acceptance rates. Right. There's a recent example in the literature looking into vaccine acceptance rates across surveys and finding that a smaller probability sample outperforms large non-probability samples in that regard. And I think in many contexts where it is really crucial to get things right, we need to stick with probability sample surveys. But I think I've also more and more come to the conclusion over the years that there is really also a place for non-probability sample surveys, like, for example, in the wage indicator. And also, in particular, I think a big strength of non-probability samples also lies in studying hidden populations, which is something that at the start of my career, I didn't think about, but it is really crucial to be able to study hidden populations, like, for example, racialized people or religious minorities and LGBTQ plus communities. And that can usually only be done with non-probability samples or a blended probability and non-probability samples. And often some research questions just require us to not hide behind the survey sampling textbook and say it can't be done, right? Just as in Kia's example. I mean, she could have said, well, it can't be done. The sampling textbook says we need to draw a huge sample in each of 200 countries and it just can't be done, right? And I think we need to find solutions and think more in terms of solving problems, even if that means sacrificing some of the desirable inferential properties.
And do you have any experience in combining, for example, a non-probability sample of hidden populations in a probability-based panel of the general population?
No, I think in particular with regard to combining specialized samples with general population samples, there's still a lot of research that needs to be done. I think we see more and more research looking into whether probability and non-probability samples can be combined, like general population probability and non-probability survey samples can be combined to increase sample size, as in Kia's example also. I think we see a lot of that, and I think that's really important research, because if you need a super large sample, then there needs to be a solution for that. But with regard to integrating special population samples into general population probability samples, I don't know of any research, but I would be happy to see it. And I think it's definitely something that needs to be done and done more in the future.
Yeah, for sure. So this is definitely a shout out to the ESRA community that we need more research on this topic, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. And Kea, so what type of recruitment do you use for your wage indicator?
Yeah, I've seen changes over time. First, in the early 2000s, I noticed for the Netherlands that the internet population changed. All of a sudden, we had a lot of unemployed persons in our survey. Before, that was around 2004. Before that time, unemployed persons had not the financial means to have internet access. But all of a sudden they did have so, and they had time enough to browse the internet. Okay, so that has changed over time. We saw elderly people coming into our sample, low skills coming into our sample. So that is what is coming in due to because our websites do quite a lot of search engine optimization so that any search terms enter land in our website. So that is all Google related search term policy. Then we did, since the, I think 2012, 14, we started to recruit through social media, which is sometimes quite expensive to do. So that is really a limit.
But what type of social media did you use?
Well, for example, I can give an example. One day we were approached by a university in Mexico, and they wanted to know what graduates from any university in Mexico was earning between 2 and 5 years after graduation. Okay, and then they came to us and say, hey, Virginicate, you're doing salary surveys. You can definitely solve our problem. Well, that was one of the first examples that we really started to recruit respondents in our survey through social media, predominantly Facebook recruitment. That is quite time consuming because it needs to, you know, address populations of that are of interest for the survey. And then you need people who instantly react when any Facebook participant reacts back to the organizers. So that is a time-consuming effort, but it was really worse if we ended up with, I think, 6,000 completed surveys in our very small target group, you know, 2 to 5 years after graduation of the university in any university in Mexico. So that was how we learned to recruit survey respondents. But so it has no sense to recruit for the full population. Facebook recruitments or any other social media recruitments only are relevant when you want to focus on very specific groups. So a famous example is that LBTH community is survey respondents are recruited through social media, full stop. So that targeting very specific groups that are of interest to any research can be recruited through Facebook and other social media. Whereas in our website, the search engine optimization, we never recruit survey respondents through search engine optimization, but we recruit them into our website where we present information about wages, because that's of interest to loads of people, and then we invite them to complete our survey. So that's a fully a different approach, rather successful also. So every year we have between 10 and 100,000 respondents, varies a bit. Over time, I've seen more reluctance to complete web surveys due to privacy discussion. I assume it's due to privacy discussions. So in the mid-2010s, we had many more survey respondents than we have currently. And I think that is due to the privacy discussions.
Do you see that in all countries?
I have to check that. I don't.
Yeah. Because I can imagine in some countries there's also like over-surveying the population, right? We are like bombarded with all types of online surveys. So, a decade or two ago, it was very nice to complete an online survey.
Yes, but people only complete a survey when the topic challenges them. You know, that's why if you want to do a survey on what people's opinion is about SOAP 1 and SOAP 2, hardly anyone starts to complete the survey because that's a topic of non-interest. So that is why all those marketing persons have so difficulties with you know, estimating the demand for their products. Okay.
Yeah, no, my question was if you see differences in response rates or like the declining response rate between countries, but.
Yeah. So I have not digged deeper into this question. It's really worthwhile to study it. Also to relate it to the number of visitors to the web, to the website. Well, do not have an answer, but I see over time that there has been an overall decline.
Yeah. So to both of you, can you give some examples of how you combine probability and non-probability samples?
Well, personally, I think what currently most people do is blended calibration techniques, right? So you basically merge the data and you apply weighting approaches first, basically calibrating the non-probability data to the probability data, and then calibrating the whole sample to the general population. I think that is the approach that currently is most commonly used. But I also think there's a lot of development in other techniques and newer techniques for blending samples in different ways. An alternative, of course, is not to blend the data sets and then give them as a blended data set to the data user, but leave the work of combining the samples to the data users, and they can do so using different modeling approaches that enable combination of samples. These, I think, are the two types of data integration that are currently popular. Personally, I think maybe that's because I'm an applied survey researcher. The more promising way is to figure out ways to first for the survey data providers to combine the samples and then give the combined data set with some instructions on how to use the data to the data user. I think that's more promising than just telling the data user you need to do something. You need to apply advanced modeling techniques because often I think that this isn't working. I mean, of course, there are researchers who do that, no question, but sometimes the data users don't know how, and then you get all kinds of results that are undesirable.
Yeah. From our side, we only provide annually our non-probability sample data set. So whoever wants to do any comparison, you know, that's challenging because our main variable are wages, and wages is it's a tricky variable to measure, extremely tricky. And it's challenging also because there are also probability samples around that measure wages. EU Silk is one of them. So that is challenging to do, really compare probability and non-probability samples, but it's not up to us to provide any merge data set whatsoever. So that's up to the users who want to use it.
Yeah, but the challenge is always to harmonize the variables, right, for the data user. So that is always a challenge. So you may want to combine wage indicator data with some other data source, but wages are measured differently, and then it becomes really hard. Yeah. So I think therefore that in the future we will see more data collection infrastructures that do both kinds of surveys in a way that is already harmonized, maybe the same design, especially web surveys. They can look exactly the same for the probability part and the non-probability part of the respondent samples, and then the data can be merged more easily than when you try to combine data that comes from different institutions, different sources, and may not be so easy to harmonize.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is the reason why we provide a full code book every year. So for all variables and all values in the variables, there is that's the code book available. And also, in addition, we have done great efforts in previous years for providing occupational coding databases. And from cases, there has been the efforts to provide educational coding-based databases. So harmonization of those difficult variables, occupation, industry, education, religion, region, so whatever, we have done great efforts to provide databases that allow for harmonization. And so particularly in web surveys, users can easily use our tools for, you know, many, many, many countries. So that really would facilitate the harmonization of variables across different surveys, data sets.
Yeah, so I think it's key to develop open source tools that other researchers can use and reuse. That will make things much more easy in the future, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. So, and if we look into the future, and let's assume that the future will bring more non-probability samples, maybe larger databases and more hybrid data. So the combination of probability and non-probability samples, or maybe different types of samples, sensor data, I don't know what. Does that also involve a change of skills for the survey researcher?
I think it mainly involves a change in mindset for the survey researchers. Mm. I think we need to move away from wanting to achieve perfect universal representativeness with regard to all variables under the sun to a fit for purpose kind of thinking, where some samples or some combinations of samples may not be universally accurate, but still useful for answering certain research questions. And I think that's the greatest challenge to figure out which data sets are fit for which purposes and under which conditions can you use a particular data set. And under which conditions do you have a data set that is not useful to you? I think that's the greatest challenge.
And in addition, enlarging the possibilities to merge data sets. So for feasible harmonization of variables. And I think there's another challenge that we came across is challenge the non-response in probability samples. That is one. The other thing that is not, I find that it is not fully addressed, is that web surveys require reading skills of the respondent, in contrast to face-to-face surveys, interviews. So that means that it is very critical how survey questions are asked. And it is critical not to, you know, on a one-to-one basis, change the question from a face-to-face survey to a web survey and then, you know, just do as if it is the same, because it is not the same. It is not the same. So that is the challenge, particularly when it comes to reading for the low-skilled survey respondents. That requires survey questions no longer, for example, than 10 words. Where have I seen that is hardly a problem for a face-to-face survey because the interviewer can explain. So I think that these kind of issues need to be addressed more often and more fully so that we get an understanding of what exactly the differences are between web surveys and face-to-face surveys, apart from being a probability and a non-probability sample.
And in particular, I think it's important that we become even better at being transparent about methodologies, because that is still hard. So it is sometimes really hard to find out what kind of sampling procedures underlying a particular survey. So you see the results, but it's really, it takes a long time often to figure out whether you actually buy into the arguments that the authors make, right? Because it's so difficult to find out about a study's methodology. And I think that's something that needs to change. Many surveys are still black boxes, in particular, of course, commercial surveys are often black boxes. But if you can't understand the data generating process, then it becomes really hard to decide what the data are useful for and whether and how you can blend them with other samples, for example. And I think that's something that should change.
Yeah, one of the things that definitely should change is that many surveys ask for occupation in an open textbook, but they do not provide the text, the coded text strings. So the second one who does a survey cannot rely on the coding that has been done in the first survey. Unless, for example, you are one organization, Statistics Netherlands, and they will pile up the coding, but any others cannot use their coding text strings. So that is really a problem.
Currently. More teamwork would be good between institutions.
Yes, for
more
sure.
Open source and more all of that. I think that would be important. More synergies also ways to integrate different kinds of data sources with each other. I think that would be really important. That not everybody can basically ask the same questions again and again and again, and gives the data only to their own data users, but that we find ways to work together more.
Yeah, that's really a challenge and a goal for the ESRA community, I think. So I just want to ask one more question, because Kea, you mentioned that you have published several papers which are non-probability survey. I must say, in my experience with publishing papers, every time I use a non-probability sample or panel, I get lots of more refusals than when I use a probability sample. Should there also be like a paradigm shift with the journal editors?
I do not have enough observations to to underpin this. I really don't know. I think so. Yeah, I know that some journals are very tough on, they want to use only papers based on probability samples, and others don't care so much, or they are satisfied once the researcher argues that, hey, my dependent variable is this, and the dependent variable in other surveys, probability surveys, is almost similar, then they are satisfied.
Yeah, I think it should not be about whether the data are probability or non-probability. It should be about whether the data fit the research purpose.
Yeah.
And so if journals rule out the possibility of publishing non-probability sample survey results, I think that's not a good way, because especially for hidden populations research, special subpopulation research, it basically means that those journals cannot publish research on such topics at all. I don't know whether there are journals that are so strict about that, but I think it's important that it's that the fitness for purpose is assessed and not probability or non-probability.
I agree.
And do you also have experience with grant proposals? Because sometimes I think when it comes to grant proposals, often they do suggest cheaper data collection and more in the non-probability realm than in the probability realm.
That's the other side of the problem. So the one side is journals that are maybe too strict, and on the other side, there are funding agencies that do not value or do not see the value in the probability sample surveys. And I think both is dangerous. And I've heard that argument a lot. You should collect cheaper data. But depending on the purpose, it's just not a good idea. Like, for example, if political decisions rely on the data, on the exact univariate estimates that you come up with, in such instances, I think we want to save money is a really bad argument, because the decisions that are based on these data are going to affect people's lives. And I think it should be worth spending funding on probability samples, whereas in other contexts, it may be true that a cheaper data collection study may lead to the same results. I think it depends.
Yeah. Well, I have a history of more than 20 years with European research proposals, and I have all of them used non-probability samples, whether it was samples of individuals or samples of occupations or samples of collective bargaining agreements. But I never was refused due to the sole argument that it was a non-probability sample. So it really matters what Karina says is, is it fit? Is the data collection fit for the research questions?
Yeah. That should always be the main question, right?
Yeah.
In when you're choosing between whatever type of sample, whatever type of recruitment, it should always fit the purpose of your study.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so one last question. When there are like young scholars listening to this podcast, do you have any suggestions for future research?
I think there's lots of research that still needs to be done. I don't know, research into data integration approaches, definitely. That's an important thing. Research into weighting approaches, better weighting approaches, easier to apply weighting approaches, especially for non-probability data sources. That will all be important. Also, recruitment. It's always an open question, both for probability and non-probability. Usually we use the most people in the recruitment in terms of panel studies, not as attrition, right? So it's early on where we lose the most people from our samples, whether it's non-probability or probability, that's where we need to get better. So all kinds of research into better recruitment approaches, yeah, I think is essential. Yeah, so lots of options.
Lots of options, yes, for sure.
Yeah, I must say, I fully support you, Karina, with the better studies or more in-depth studies on the recruitment. It always reminds me on the invitation for face-to-face interviews, by definition, will have data on people who are at home. Whereas web-based survey recruitment, by definition, has people who are on the internet. And there is not such a big overlap between the two. So an understanding of which recruitment methods recruits which type of populations, and how we can understand these populations, what the characteristics are of these populations, that is really a thing that needs further research, full stop.
Yeah. And to find targeted approaches based on that knowledge, right? Targeted approaches that fit the particular groups of people and how to best address each of those groups early on in the recruitment to figure out how to invite people, whether to some people you should send an interview, to others you should send an invitation link for a web survey, how to figure out how to make those decisions early on. I think that would be important and really helpful.
Yeah.
And also the effects on the logistics, right? Because that would also be affected when you are using adaptive survey design.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you so much for this great discussion. This is the end of the podcast, and I will I would like to thank you for listening, and thank you, Karina and Kea, for having this podcast with me. And see you later. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.